beautiful. I hope it was inspiring. I hope that our Shir HaShirim learning made an impact. I know it did for me. I had a very different experience of Shir HaShirim, both Seder night and on Shabbos Chol HaMoed as a result of the learning that we did together. And now we're up to Koheles, and of course it's Yom HaShoah today, and I feel like that's exactly the day to start learning Koheles, in the sense that this is a book of questions and challenges, and what do we believe? And it's not necessarily the part of Yom HaShoah that people think about more. We tend to spend more time thinking about all that we lost, but the questions that emerge from it are certainly very relevant in a book like this. And you know what a book this is. I have put off talking about this book for so long. This is actually the 14th year of our Tuesday afternoon series, and all but one of the years we did Tanakh. Right? There was one year when we did Bereishis Rabbah, the Midrashim on Parsha Shmos specifically. But we did Treyasar, we did Daniel, we did Yeshaya, we did Eov, we did Ezra and Nehemiah, and of course earlier this year, Shir HaShirim and Mishlei, and last year we did Melachim, let's not forget that. I guess it's a good wrap-up to do Koheles. Excuse me, to finally tackle Koheles in our series. It's a remarkable book. It has many passages in it that are very well known. Havel Havalim Amar Koheles, as it's often translated, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Dor Holech V'Dor Ba, the generation goes, the generation comes, the land remains forever. Let's not forget the famous song, which was a passage in Koheles before it was a song, right? In the beginning of the third parak, the third chapter, Eis Laledes, Eis Lamus, Eis Latas, Eis Lakor Natua, right? To all things there is a time to be born, a time to die, and so on. There's so much here that has made it into the popular mindset. And it's a challenging book. The ideas in it are challenging. It has a confounding structure, if it can be said to have a structure at all, as we're going to talk about. It's a very intimidating book to try to talk about. Nonetheless, like I said, we've been doing this long enough. Let's see what we can get out of it. As with the rest of the classes that we've had, I intend to post audio recordings on YU Torah, and once we have a collection of audio recordings on that website, then I'll be sending out a link each week when I send out the source sheets for people to be able to listen to any that they've missed. Here's how I want to approach the book. Right? We have 10 or 11 weeks of classes. I want to begin by talking about. Well, first I'm going to introduce the book overall, but then I'm going to talk about authorship, who wrote the book. And I'm bringing that at the outset. Normally I like to first discuss more of the book and then talk about the authorship. But in this case, you need to discuss the authorship as part of discussing the challenges of the book. The two issues are intertwined. Once we've done that, I want to do an overview of the content and the challenges. Talk about different approaches to dealing with the challenges that are raised within the book, specifically the ideological and theological challenges of the book. Then, once we've done that, we can talk content in a serious way. So, we can talk about what I think of as the main theme of the book, the value of human endeavor. Is it worth doing anything? That's basically a central question of this book. Some of the major terms that come up that need to be defined for the book come up in that context of that discussion, like the term Hevel, the term Amal, things like that. And then, want to talk about the relationship between this book and the book of Iyov, the book of Tehillim, the book of Mishle. We'll be talking about that a little bit in the beginning, actually, but then maybe we'll do it in greater depth. And then we'll learn particular passages from the book, starting with the beginning, because the beginning really does introduce its philosophy, and then we'll see how much time we have to get to everything else. When we did Mishle, I think we spent 7 weeks on the introduction. So, I don't know. We'll have to see. All right. I begin with questions or comments before we go any further. Nope, the overview was clear. Excellent. That's the last clear thing we will have. Okay. I called this, if you look at the top of the sheet, King Solomon's War. And specifically, and more broadly, I should have really written, it's King Solomon's War on Mishle and Iyov. It's his war against those two books. Here's what I mean by that. In Tanakh, and we said this when we learned Mishle, the books of Kohelet, Mishle, and Iyov are frequently called wisdom literature. Right? You remember the term. Some of Tehillim is sometimes also called that. And when we learned that, we gave a little bit of a definition of what exactly wisdom literature is. I gave you a quote that Professor Avigdor Hurwitz brought from Gerhard von Rad, which I brought you in the sheet. I'm looking at the sheet and realizing it's source number 2, and I'm trying to figure out why I put that after source number 1. I think it was just a mistake that I did it in that order. So take a look at source number 2. This is just what we did when we learned Mishle, just defining wisdom literature. I'm going to read my English translation. In the broad definition of Gerhard von Rad, wisdom literature is characterized by practical knowledge of the laws of life and the world based in experience, meaning the authority of the sage and the authority of wisdom literature springs not from divine revelation, but from the sage's personal experience or the collective experience of the community whom the sage presents and which the sage presents and transmits. So, in other words, wisdom literature tries to convey wisdom that has been accumulated by human beings, guiding our practical lives. By nature, in many societies where wisdom literature shows up, it's not religious. It's not about lessons from God. That doesn't mean that it's atheistic. That doesn't mean that it's secular in the modern senses of those words, atheist or secular. It's not like that. It just tends not to refer to God as an authority. That's what makes something literature. Wisdom literature is that it is human wisdom for life. But in Tanakh, what people call wisdom literature, Iyov, Mishle, Koheles, does tend to include religious language and themes, as we saw when we learned Mishle. It does have a religiosity to it. From my perspective, that's just fine. It's in Tanakh. If you are, on the other hand, an academic, you're not approaching it from a religious perspective, then you approach the religious language that's found in Mishle or Koheles differently. So there's a book called Koheleth, The Man and His World by Robert Gordas. It's one of the major works from the 20th century on Koheles, in which he says the reason why the language in Koheles is so religious is because that's the vocabulary of the environment in which Koheles is written. That's the way they talk. Others have argued that the reason why you see religious expressions and statements in Koheles is because it gets mixed in later on to purify the book. We'll talk more about that idea later. Needless to say, I don't agree, but we'll talk more about who else doesn't agree in a little while. But wisdom literature in general is supposed to be wisdom that human beings have amassed that gives guidance for one's existence. There are two basic types of wisdom literature. The two basic kinds. One is practical wisdom, and the other is abstract intellectual wisdom. And here I brought you a very interesting piece from Professor Yaakov Klein. It appears in the Olam HaTanach edition of the Megillot, specifically of Kohelet. And it's a very interesting insight into the nature of practical wisdom and intellectual wisdom found in wisdom literature. Take a look. He says, and again, I'm going to read my English translation. There's an awful lot of Hebrew there. Feel free to track it along with the Hebrew. In all of the literatures of the ancient Eastern nations, as well as Tanakh, one can discern two types of wisdom. On one hand is didactic practical wisdom, which teaches a person how to live daily life so that his deeds succeed, and he lives a life of osher. I didn't have a good translation for osher. Osher is with an aleph, not osher with an ayin. Osher with an aleph is not, like the word ashrei, is not easy to translate. You could say fortunate, you could say happy, you could say satisfaction. None of them really work as a literal translation. So I just left it as osher. Opposite that, opposite the practical wisdom, is analytic philosophical wisdom, which deals with questions at the height of the world, like the problem of divine justice, a person's lot and his position before God, the meaning of life and death, and the like. Philosophy. Practical wisdom, which is represented in Tanakh primarily by the book of Mishle, right? Think of the advice that we saw in Mishle when we learned Mishle. Very, you know, to the point type of adages, generally wears the form of a short, pithy saying born in the mouth of the nation or the sages. So it's what people say. Wise sayings enable a person to learn from the experience of others and grant him the knowledge necessary to guide his actions in such ways that will prevent error and bring success. The natural form of the saying is a general declaration, like, then he quotes here from Shmuel, when David is talking to Shaul, when David has the opportunity to harm Shaul and he chooses not to, and David says to Shaul, "Merishaim yetzei rasha," from the wicked emerges wickedness. Bad people do bad things. Right? It's a short observation about how the world works. And it's said in a vacuum. But sometimes it is expressed as a sage's advice, and it gives you a piece from Malachim. The one who girds his sword should not be praised like the one who has wielded it. The one who has actually used it is greater than the one who has simply, you know, strapped on a sword. Practical wisdom champions a worldview that is conservative, educational, and optimistic. It believes in the doctrine of reward and promises good reward and a long life of osher, there's that word again, to the righteous person who reveres heaven and walks a straight path. On the other hand, it promises punishment and a bad lot for the wicked who rebels against God and chooses to walk a wicked path, right? This is what we saw in Mishle, right? Mishle, with its practical advice, believes the world is a good place. Do what's right and good things will happen to you. Do bad things and bad things will happen to you. This wisdom assumes a fixed and just order to the world established by God, and it is placed upon a person to align himself with those rules in order to earn success in life. In other words, what you could say, practical wisdom is Frum. The practical wisdom found in Tanakh, in wisdom literature, believes there is a God who is running the show, there is reward, there is punishment, the things you should do are generally moral, ethical things, the things you should avoid are corrupt, arrogant, egotistical things. Now he talks about intellectual wisdom, and then I'm going to pause. Analytic philosophical wisdom, represented in Tanakh primarily by the book of Eov, deals, in contrast to practical wisdom, with questions at the height of the world. What is the meaning of a person's life on earth? What is his position before God? Is there a just order to the world, such that the righteous receives his reward and the wicked his punishment? He keeps going here. I just finally skipped because I was retyping everything in the Hebrew. Bad enough to do that and then translate it. The literature of analytic wisdom is critical and radical when compared with traditional beliefs. So analytic wisdom, if those of you who learned Eov with me will remember this, challenges and says, who knows whether good people are going to get rewarded or worse? Bad people get rewarded and good people suffer. And God isn't paying attention and God isn't communicating and so on. The literature of analytic wisdom is different from the literature of practical wisdom in its literary forms too. As opposed to the individual sayings and brief wise advice of practical wisdom, right? Think Mishlei. Short pieces, one sentence, two sentences, three sentences, move on to something else. The book of Eov and its Mesopotamian analogs include long speeches with philosophical plans, structure, monologues, and dialogues. And you already know, if you did Eov with me, that I don't consider the Mesopotamian works to really be analogous to Eov. They're very different. But his point is well taken. The structure that you see in Eov and in those works are these very long speeches. Eov, remember, right? Eov talks, and then Eliphaz talks, and then Eov talks, and then Bildad, and then Eov, and then so far, and around speeches that can run for a chapter, two chapters, three chapters. So these are the two basic kinds of wisdom literature that you find in Tanakh. Practical wisdom, which says, do good things and good things will happen to you, represented by Mishlei. An analytic philosophical wisdom, which says, I don't know how the world works. And it isn't necessarily what everybody thinks. And it isn't necessarily orderly and safe and fair. That kind of an approach is represented by Eov in Tanakh. Are we clear? Questions, comments? Oh, come on, really? Susan, thank you. Which?
I understand the intellectual wisdom.
Yeah.
But saying that the good, I know when we did, as a failure, we did problems, it's just, now you're saying it's not wisdom.
What do you mean?
When the good do, it's not wisdom because the good don't always get good and the bad don't always get punished. And so how can you call that wisdom? You can
right.
call it
So if you go back to the class that we had, two classes that we had where we talked about this question, I don't remember whether you had come back to class by then or not, but it was week 4 or week 5 of the Mishlei series. We asked that question of how Mishlei can say this. How Mishlei, and we talked about, and we gave answers for how that fits and even how it will be called wisdom.
But when you say,
yeah.
One thing is with Mishlei, we found a reason, but the whole concept of wisdom and giving a pass to people who are good always get good, and people who are bad always get bad. It doesn't add up to 4.
So look, you're in the right book because we're in Koheles now. But Mishlei will answer you. This is actually the wiser way to look at the world. That's Mishlei's answer. To you, it's not true.
Do you see good people not suffering?
That doesn't mean that what you're saying is a, that doesn't mean that what you're saying is a wise way to look at the world. I'm not rehashing Mishlei now. That's not fair. You're gonna have to go back to there. But yes, that, what I am saying is that there is a way to construe that as a wise way to look at the world. Yes, absolutely. To adopt that narrative and to see that as the view of how the world works and the other, events as anomalies, that can be viewed as a wise way to look at the world. I'm not the only one to say so, but I am saying so.
I'm sure. Also, I just want to tell you, JTA is running a lesson, evaluating
Okay. I'm sure there are people around the world who are learning Koheles right now. But I will not be beholden to what JTA has to say. When you deal with Mishlei.
Somebody's asking a question, Bert.
No.
Oh, there you are. Esther, are you trying to ask something?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Is it safe to assume that back in the day that these were written, that they didn't necessarily see them as part of a set? You know, they weren't necessarily aware or trying to all create something that we now call wisdom literature.
So, in terms of viewing Qohelet and Mishlei as being a set, we're going to talk more about that when we talk about Shlomo as the author. Certainly, even though Midrashim put it as Shlomo writing these at different times in his life, there's one that says he writes them together, but there's a bigger school of thought that says he writes them at different times in his life. That reflects a sense of an evolution, that this is written and then this is written because ideas change, or he's presenting a different perspective on the world. Eov is an entirely different entity. Eov is decidedly not looking at itself as being part of anything else. It's its own thing, and we talked about when we learned Eov, you know, we don't know when it was written, we don't know who wrote it. The Talmud has multiple views on both of those, and we can't give a clear definitive answer. What I would ask, and maybe this is where you're going, I'm not sure, is the question of when they canonize Tanakh and include all of these, are they viewed as a set? Is there some sense that they're trying to present point and counterpoint with them? They don't get grouped together in Tanakh, meaning we're going to talk about where they appear in Tanakh. It might actually be on the source sheet. Yeah, if you take a look at source number 10, the Talmud's listing of the different books in the Ketuvim, the last part of Tanakh, has Ruth first, then Tehillim, then Eov, then Mishlei, Qohelet, and Shir HaShirim together as the writings of Shlomo. Their order is chronological, meaning Ruth, then Tehillim attributed to King David, then Eov, because why not? You know, you can attribute it to whoever you like and you'd have somebody to support you. Followed by Shlomo's books, then Kinos, end of the first base, Hamikdash Yirmiyahu, then Daniel, Esther, Ezra, right, the Babylonian exile and the return from it, followed by Divrei HaYamim, wrapping things up. So, you know, that's a school of thought which says, well, we're going to just put this with the one who wrote it, as opposed to trying to group it as a group. Although, to be fair, when you do it that way, Eov, Mishlei, and Qohelet do end up side by side. So maybe there is something to say there. I don't know. So I'm not really answering you, except to say, from an authorship perspective, I don't think so. From a canonizer perspective, it doesn't look like they're lumping it together.
Yeah, and I didn't want to raise the canonizing question again, but it was more the question of, you know, were they trying to emulate a certain type of literature that would be part of a set of literature?
Right. I see. I don't know. So when we learned Mishlei, we saw practical wisdom and a book that fits in very, very nicely in Tanakh, right? It was advice about how one should live life. It tended to be very optimistic. If you're looking on the sheet at source number 3, I gave you references to some verses which are worth seeing just to refresh our memory from Mishlei. I'm going to flip to it in my own Tanakh here. So Mishlei chapter 13, right, sentences 20, 21, we add the statement, Holech Chachamim, one second, yeah, Holech Es Chachamim Yechkam, one who walks with sages will become wise. Vorek Silim Yeroa, whereas if you hang out with the fools, so, you know, that's what you're gonna get. Chataim Tiradef Ra'ah, sin pursues those who do bad things. Ve'as Tzadikim Yishalem Tov, and to the righteous, good will be paid. So you do bad things, you get bad stuff. You do good things, you get good stuff. It also tends to be very conservative in the outlook on how the world works. Like we just said, good behavior is rewarded, bad behavior leads to suffering. And even though we saw at the end of that chapter, we did see in sentence 23, Yesh nispe belo mishpat, there are those who meet their end without justice, we saw lots of ways to reinterpret that sentence that would fit Mishlei's general outlook. Stylistically, Mishlei is pithy, short statements, objective observations, like the ones we've seen here in chapter 13, or direct instructions. If you take a look at Mishlei chapter 3, sentence 1, as one example of it, Bini, my son, Tarasi al tishkach, don't forget my teachings, don't forget my Torah. Right? It's an instruction, it's an imperative. So, Mishlei is very much like what Professor Klein said it is. Right? It's this conservative book of advice for how to live your life. The world rewards, the world punishes, and the style is these short statements. Now we look at Koheles. And Koheles has a funny opposition to Mishlei. First of all, its content disagrees with Mishlei. If you take a look on your sheet, source number 4, I gave you references to verses that we're going to look at one by one. So take a look at chapter 7, sentence 20. Are human beings good? Well, ki adam ein tzadik ba'aretz asher ya'aseh tov v'lo yecheta. There is nobody in the land who does good and doesn't sin. Now, you could read that and just sort of shrug and say nobody's perfect. But you could also read it as an indictment of human beings. Everybody is criminal. Everybody is crooked. On some level, people are all doing bad things. Two different ways you could intone that sentence. The book argues that wisdom isn't what it's cracked up to be. Go back to chapter 2, sentence 15. Ve'amarti ani bilibi, I said in my heart, kimikre ha'kisio gamani yekreni, what happens to the fool is going to happen to me also. Ve'lava chachamti ani az yoser, why did I bother to get extra wisdom? For what purpose? I said, yeah, this is hevel, whatever hevel means. Right now I'll just translate hevel as worthlessness, but that's not what it means. It's just a good way to frame it. This is a book that calls out human injustice. Chapter 3, sentence 16. Va'od ra'isi tachas hashamesh. I also saw under the sun, mikom hamishpat shama haresha, the place of justice, there's wickedness there. Mikom hatzedek, the place of righteousness, shama harasha, that's where the wicked person is. Human beings are unjust. And not only that, jump ahead now to chapter 7, sentence 15. Again, these are all there on your sheet, so if you can't catch one, you can always come back to it later. But chapter 7, sentence 15, Koheleth says, Es hakol ra'isi bimei hevli, in my worthless life, I've seen it all. Yesh tzadik oved b'tzidko, there's a righteous person who is destroyed in his righteousness. V'yesh rasha ma'arich b'raso, and there are wicked people who go on for a very long time in their wickedness. So he calls out apparent divine injustice as well. The content is anti-Mishlei. However, unlike what we said about philosophical wisdom, the book uses the methods that we associate with Mishlei's practical wisdom, and it subverts them. It borrows the styles. Meaning, take a look, for example, at chapter 9, sentence 2. This is an objective observation. Hakol ka'asher lakol. Mikrecha latzadik v'la rasha, latov v'la tahor v'la tameh v'la zoveach v'la sharein enu zoveach. Everybody meets the same end. It's the same thing, whether you're righteous or whether you're wicked, whether you're good, whether you're pure, whether you're impure. You bring sacrifices, you don't bring sacrifices. Don't worry about it. The same fate befalls everybody. It makes an objective observation in the style that you would see in Mishle to say things that are the opposite of what Mishle would say. Jump back to chapter 7, sentence 16. Remember we said that in Mishle sometimes you see an imperative? Bini, my son, remember my teachings? So here you have an imperative also. Chapter 7, sentence 16. Al tehi tzadik harbe. Don't be such a tzadik. Val tischakam yoser. Don't try to be too wise. Lama tishamein. Why should you be destroyed? Why should you meet ruin? Yeah, why should you can invest all that effort in it? It's often collections of individual statements, not structured speeches. The whole chapter 7 in general in Koheles is it's statements that don't necessarily really connect to each other, much like we saw in Mishle. So my point and what I'm trying to say here is that Shlomo, as author of Koheles, and we'll talk about Shlomo as author when we get to discuss authorship, but he's declaring war on the sunny approach of Mishle. In Mishle land, everything is great. In Koheles land, everything is terrible. Mishle has a style of making these short observations about the world. Shlomo says, yeah, I can do that too. I mean, he's the author of both. I can do that here also, but say the opposite. You can give instructions, my son, do this in Mishle, and I'm going to do it in Koheles also, but to give him very different instructions. It is a war on the sunny approach of Koheles. If Mishle is spring leading into summer, Koheles is the terrible weather that we get here the day after summer started, right? That's what that's what it is. And then let's talk Eov. So Eov, we said, is a work of philosophical wisdom, the debates between the visitors and Eov. And the visitors each present views that are harder to reconcile with our lived experience. Right? Take a look in Eov, and again, on your sheet in source number 5, I gave you a few links that would help. These are just representative samples from each of Eov's visitors. So Eliphaz believes in reward and punishment. In chapter 22, sentences 23 to 28, Eliphaz says to Eov, if you will return to God, you will be built up. Distance corruption from your house. That's what he says you ought to do. And then God will help you out and everything will be wonderful. That's Eliphaz. If you're suffering, it's because you sinned. Return to God and it will be good. That's Eliphaz. Bildad, back in chapter 8 in Eov. Sentences 6 and 7. I always think of this as the classic statement of what Bildad believes. If something bad is happening to you, it's actually good for you. You just don't know it yet. But really, the suffering is good for you, he says. Take a look at in Eov chapter 8, sentences 6 and 7. He says, yeah, in the beginning, you were in this very narrow place. In the end, you will flourish. It's going to be wonderful. Don't worry about it. It'll end well. And then you had Sophar. Take a look at Eov chapter 11, sentences 7 to 9. Sophar is the one who argues God has a plan. If you take a look, again, we're still in source number 5 on the sheet, so you can see the references there. Chapter 11, sentences 7 to 9. He says, are you able to find God's plan? Is that accessible to you? What do you know of the heavens? What do you know of the depths? God's plan is broader, is longer than the land and broader than the sea. God has a bigger plan. Each of them presented their view of how the world works. And as we said from Professor Newsom when we learned Eov, it's in source number 6, people buy into these cultural worldviews even when events don't fit. They just write them off as an anomaly. I brought you Newsom's quote, but I think that I've used it before with this group. I think I used it when we did Mishle, so I'm not going to read it out. You can see it for yourself. But she talks about, as an example, how people say that if you work hard in business, then you will succeed. And we all know people who tried that and it didn't work, but we keep on saying it anyway. And we write that off as an anomaly. We have our beliefs about how the world works, and that's what these visitors are like. In Eov, we get people presenting their views of how the world works. There is a narrative, there is a structure to this world, and this is the way things go. In Koheles, you get an anti-narrative. It's the opposite. Koheles goes around and around and around with no clear structure, from one theme to another and then back to the first one, and he argues with himself. Take a look in Koheles now, and I gave you the references in source number 7. Look at Koheles chapter 2, sentence 2. Lischok amarti meholal ulisimcha mazo osa. He says, of schok, playing, right? So I said that it was meholal. Now, you could translate the word meholal in a couple of different ways, but many believe that what he's saying is, it's a good thing here. That joy is a good thing. You could read it as being empty. But keeping one finger there, take a look at chapter 5, sentence 15. In which he says, was it 5:15? That's what I wrote on here. No, that's not what I wanted. All right, I will have to find later what I wanted from 5:15. But that's not the sentence that I thought I was giving you. But take a look at chapter 7, sentence 3. Yeah. In chapter 7, sentence 3, he says, Tov kas mi sechok. Better to be angry than to be joyous, than to be happy. Elsewhere, he had positive things to say about being happy, and then there he has negative things to say about being happy. Or, give you another example, go back to chapter 2, sentence 13. In chapter 2, sentence 13, he says, I have seen that there is an advantage to chachma over sichlut. There's an advantage to wisdom over foolishness. It's like the benefit of light over dark. Wisdom is good. Right? That's what he's saying there pretty clearly. Now you jump to chapter 7, sentence 12. And he tells us, ha-chochma t'chaye be'aleha. Wisdom will keep its holder alive. Wisdom is life-saving. It's a great thing. But in between those two passages, we get chapter 6, sentence 8, which says, Kima yoser lechacham min hakesil. How is the wise person any better off than the fool? And of course, we also saw earlier other statements like that in Koheles. So what Koheles does is he takes the idea of narratives, the idea that there's a structure, that you can look at the world and come up with a coherent philosophy to explain it. And he says, who are you kidding? You think that you found the philosophy of the world? There's no philosophy of the world. You think that it's better to be happy than to be sad? You have a point, except that I think sometimes it's better to be sad than to be happy. You believe that. I'm just looking to see if I can find what I meant when I said 5:15. You know what? Here we go. Chapter 8:15. That's why. I don't know why I wrote 5. Sorry, look at chapter 8, sentence 15. Yeah, that's what I was going for. You see that? Chapter 8, sentence 15 was very positive. He says, "V'shibachti ani es hasimcha, I praise joy. Asher ein tov la'adam tachas hashemesh kiim le'achol v'lishtos v'lismoach. There's nothing better for a human being than to eat, drink, and be merry. V'hu yilvenu ba'amalo, and it will escort him in his struggle. Yimei chayav asher nasan lo'ho elokim tachas hashemesh, the days of his life that God gave him under the sun." So that's where he says it's good to be joyous. And then he said, on the other end, tov kas mischov, better to be angry than to be happy. So what he's doing is he's demolishing the idea of narratives. And this is a war against Eov's idea of narratives in this world. You see what I'm saying to you? Are we being somewhat clear? Not too clear. I wouldn't want to go for that, but at least somewhat. You've got a mishle, which tells you that the world is a good place. He takes the conventions of mishle, the structure and style of mishle, to say the opposite. You have an Eov, which talks about how this world is understandable. Each of them offers a narrative to explain it. And frankly, at the end of the book, God gives Eov a narrative. God says to him, there is reward and there is punishment and there's a lot more going on than you can understand. And everything that you see, God says to Eov, everything you see, the things you don't understand and the things that you think you understand, they're all anomalies. Everything you see is an anomaly. You don't understand? You can't understand, Eov. That's what God says to Eov. That's God's narrative, so to speak, in that book. In Koheles, forget it. The whole concept doesn't make any sense. There's no such thing as understanding it. So this is what I think of as Shlomo's war. It's a war on ideas and values held broadly in society. It's a war on positive human emotions and experiences like love and joy and pleasure. It's a war on human achievement, amassing wisdom, building structures, leaving a legacy. It's a war on human social structure. He criticizes human justice. He criticizes government. And what I think we're going to see, to me, what's going to come out of this, because if I stopped right here, you're like, wow, this is depressing. Let me just skip the next 9 weeks, 10 weeks. But what I think we're going to see is a lesson in how to live a religious life even when we are at war with the world. Even when you agree with nobody, even when there's no narrative and mishle seems simplistic and all of that, there's still a way. That's what I think Koheles is trying to provide. I'm going to pause for questions and comments. Yeah, Hannah.
Listening now.
Yeah, no, I think the book of the adjectives that people use to talk about Koheles generally are skepticism and cynicism. And it's consistent with the idea, which we won't get to today, but the idea that we mentioned when we learned Mishle, that Shlomo writes it at the end of his life. Which, you know, when you learn Malachim, it's, you know, he's come down far from the heights that he had earlier in life. So the cynicism would be appropriate if that's so.
Okay.
Yeah. Rose, you were going to say?
It's hard to remove.
Yes. It's hard for Amunah, but on the other hand, it's a redeeming book for people who are having a hard time with Amunah.
And just the fact that our sages chose to include it in our Tanakh means that there is value of this book to our Amunah.
Yes.
We just have to find it.
Yes. And there's a lot to be said about that, which we're going to come to. Thalia?
To me, the difference between all these approaches reminds me, I mean, we just went through the Haggadah, right? The four sons. And we have the Rasha, who is the cynic. Like, what good is this for me? Like, I'm not going to get anything out of it.
Right.
And the Chacham who wants to find out how to suffer or how to be pure or how to do the good things, like Eo's narrative, you know, like and find out, you know, how to be a better person, how to get rewarded at the end.
Right.
And the simple person who's just like the fool, okay, you know, just lives life, has a good time, doesn't really care, doesn't have a question. One way or another. And, you know, so I kind of see that, you know, the response of Judaism is to say, we are going to be all those people at some time in our life. We're going to be, you know, a lot of teenagers get very cynical when you're in your 20s, and then you sort of, maybe things turn around for you, you get happy. Then you get old and you get sick and you get cynical and angry again. And you just have to be prepared to argue with yourself. And I think that's what the reason why all these things are included.
Right. I'm not going to go back to your characterization of the Chacham and the Tam. I think there are things worth discussing there. But I think overall, definitely true that it's not that there actually are four Bunim running around. It's that these are all points of view that have to be addressed within a person. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Other questions and comments on this sort of just framing of the book before we move into authorship? Okay.
Can I just ask, is this really, when you think about it, the life cycle of human life and represented by Solomon?
So when the Midrashim presents Shir HaShirim as his youth and Mishle as his middle age and Kohelet as his old age, they're very much making a comment on the flow of human life. They actually talk about that in those Midrashim, about the different, you know, the content of each and how it fits with different stages. You do see that, yeah. Okay. So let's talk authorship. And we're only going to start this now. We're not going to complete it. Like I said in the beginning, I would bring this later all together once we've met the book in a stronger way. But I'm bringing it here because you can't talk about the challenges of the book without talking about the authorship. So first of all, the status of Kohelet as a single unified text, an issue I alluded to before. Clearly, as the text goes around and around and around, revisiting topics, apparently contradicting its own advice and its own worldview, there's a strong temptation to read it as a document assembled from multiple sources. For whatever reason, different things got blended together. And here, I'm going to refer you to Robert Gordas, who I mentioned earlier. Professor Gordas is considered to be one of the big writers in the academic world on Kohelet. I have no doubt that since his heyday, which was the 50s and 60s, I believe, there have risen those who have discounted him altogether and redone and whatever. And I've read some of the later writers as well. But nonetheless, when I learned Kohelet when I was at YU, I took a class on Kohelet. He was mentioned a lot. And he continues to be mentioned and discussed. And here I found particular value in what he had to say. So take a look at source number 8. I also learned about something I didn't know about. Someone clued me in. Microsoft Word now has an option called Dictate. in which you can speak and it will convert it to text. So their Hebrew preview version isn't so great, but their English is solid. And it was very good because I had to retype a whole lot of text for number 8 and I wasn't going to do it. And then I found out I could read it to it. And it actually did a very good job. So just recommending that for people to use that. Gordas writes the following. At the end of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th, critical students of the book by and large tended to regard the work as consisting of an original nucleus of heterodox, skeptical material, which had then been extensively glossed by readers in an effort to make it palatable to the Orthodox and thus find a place for it in the canon. Orthodox lowercase o, but just in general. To make it fit better with classic Jewish teachings, the stuff got thrown in, glossed, as it's put there. Even this more moderate approach, however, bristles with difficulties that have been generally ignored. In the entire book, which consists of only 222 verses, Jastrow, he assumes 120 interpolations. 120 texts stuck into the 222 verses of Koheles. Now, he may not have counted verses, quite frankly, because it's true. When you read Koheles, it feels like a lot longer than 222 verses. So maybe it felt like 500, and therefore 120 didn't seem like a lot. I'm joking. But the point is that when they try to read it as a text with things thrown in, they end up needing to assume that almost everything in it is not original. Like, you're gonna tell me that half the book was inserted into it? And then he goes on to say, actually no, before he goes on to say, he says the following, he says, he goes on to point out two main objections to this approach. His first objection to the approach is, the sages of Israel had no problem banning books. There were lots of books which they said should not be read. If they didn't like Koheles, they wouldn't have bothered to save it. They would have simply buried it. Take a look at what he says here, the second paragraph. None of these scholars seeks to explain why the book was deemed worthy of this effort to legitimatize it, when it could so easily have been suppressed. There were many other works written in this period, now known as the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, all attributed to ancient worthies, which were far less objectionable to the alleged Orthodox sentiment of the time. You have lots of books that get written out of Tanakh, and we're told don't read them, that are not nearly as objectionable as a book that says good people and bad people both meet the same fate. If it was clear that a given book had been compiled after prophecy had ceased in Israel, or if it contradicted traditional halacha, or if it contained apocalyptic visions of last things or other doctrines upon which normative Judaism frowned, no elaborate effort was undertaken to counteract its heterodox features by glosses and interpolations, as is assumed for Koheleth. Instead, such works were withdrawn by the authorities from public use by being stored away in the Geniza and thus consigned to oblivion and ultimate destruction. He says, the books that sages didn't approve of didn't make it. They didn't bother trying to stitch them together and make them acceptable. If they didn't like Koheles, you wouldn't know it had ever existed. That's point number one. Point number two goes to a point about chronology. Now, Gordas' chronology for Koheles is different from mine. Meaning, I'm telling you that I believe, as the sages said, it's written by Shlomo HaMelech. He was not of that belief. He believed that it was written in the middle of the Second Temple period for a variety of reasons. Part of it is the language, the words that are used. Part of it is the themes that it addresses. We'll talk more about that, I hope, next week. But his point is, he says, if you, as an academic, believe that it was written in the middle of the Second Temple period, there isn't enough time for it to have been purified by having the sages throw in different texts and clean it up. There isn't enough time for the text to evolve into the form that we are familiar with, because we know by the end of the Second Temple period, it is already a major influence on other writings. Take a look. He says, we're on the last page of the handout, the second paragraph. Moreover, the theory of tendentious additions to Koheleth raises extensive problems of chronology. It is difficult to believe that in the ancient Orient, where time moved slowly and changes were few, so many steps in the process could have been consummated in a comparatively short time. He says it's not realistic to think that that was what they did. He also points out that by his day, the middle of the 20th century, biblical scholarship had moved away from declaring every text in Tanakh as a product of multiple sources. He says, problems such as these impelled so consistent an advocate of the source analysis school. Source analysis is the school that says, let's look back at the texts and see how many texts it was composed of and where it was written and so on. So such an advocate as Cunin to confess in the heyday of the documentary hypothesis. It may be hard to demonstrate the unity of Koheleth, but it is even harder to deny it. I thought that was a great line. 20th century biblical scholarship is increasingly motivated by a general reaction against the extremes of 19th century higher criticism in general. Higher criticism being the type of criticism that doesn't tackle a specific sentence, but rather broadly, where is this text from and who wrote it and when did they write it and that kind of a thing. In growing measure, it is being recognized that the atomization of biblical books, breaking them up into this part was written by E and J and whoever else, is an unnecessary hypothesis, and by that token, untrue. For though unconscionably neglected in biblical studies, William of Ockham's principle remains fundamental to the scientific method. And I'll just read my English as opposed to the Latin. It's not my English, it's a standard translation. Entities must not be multiplied more than necessary. Meaning, when you are trying to explain something, when you're trying to explain a phenomenon, don't invent a whole bunch of steps in order to show how it got to where it is today. Take the simplest possible approach. Now, Occam's razor, as it's usually known, has its logical flaws. But his point is, biblical scholarship has completely thrown it out the window. And they just keep on saying, well, this sentence could be divided into three parts and four parts, and it reflects this era and that point of view and that agenda. In the study of Koheleth, the last few decades have introduced a growing recognition among scholars of its basic unity. He says, it's a single book from a single author, except that, I should note, he believes that there's an introductory sentence in the beginning, and that there's an epilogue at the end that are added later. That he does believe. But other than that, it's one author. And as far as the fact that it goes around and around and it has all these apparent contradictions, and the fact that at some points it's very frum and at other points it's very cynical, he says that's the personality of the book. The blending of conventional and unconventional wisdom, as he calls it, is the point of Koheleth, along the lines of what I was trying to say. This is a book about how you deal with the world when you're at war with everybody else's ideas. That's what I'm seeing here. So what I want to start with next time is to start with our sages saying that it is Shlomo who wrote it. Why I would say that Shlomo is the author. The big question you have to ask, if you're saying you wrote it as Shlomo, then why did you call yourself Koheleth in the book? And what are the arguments against Shlomo as the author? And then I want to show you some attempts to outline the book and its content, so we can get some sense of the overall flow or non-flow of the book. So hopefully that'll be next week. I'll just note, I originally had said that our series is going to end June 27th. I think I am going to have an issue with that date. So the last session that we have, I may have to pick a different date for, but we have some time between now and then to figure that out. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.